Hello, and welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. This is episode 24, Tuesday, October 18th. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Hey, Scott.
Howdy.
Good evening. It is a crisp fall evening here in Minnesota.
Indeed.
How are you?
Good.
It's been a while since we've podcast. There's a lot of things to talk about. But I feel like we would be remiss if we did not start with the new shiny thing dangling from your wrist.
I am sporting my 42mm Series 2 Apple Watch in gold aluminum with a cocoa band.
A cocoa band?
Yes.
I commented to you before we started, aren't you supposed to have a brown band? Because it doesn't look brown to me. But I would grant you cocoa.
It is sort of a grayish brown, and I actually really like it, that it isn't. It's sort of an unnatural brown.
It looks good. I have to admit, the gold looks better than I thought it was going to.
I actually really like it because, you know, it's not a metallic gold. You know, it's almost like a matte gold, you know? It's not shiny. I like it a lot. I just got it today. I've been wearing it for a couple hours, so I don't really have a full-on review or anything yet. All I have to review so far is, like, the setup process.
I've heard that it's a little bit long.
Yeah, and slow. Like, it's a multi-step process. You're going through, like, a wizard in the watch app, and each phase, you got a spinner that spins and spins, and, I mean, it would take, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds between phase of setup, and there were like 10 phases. Like, it was kind of it took me probably 30 minutes to set it up.
Wow.
Which was very surprising and unexpected for something that I thought you would just turn it on and have it work.
I wonder if it's using, you know, Bluetooth or some, maybe a low energy, you know, slow bitrate version of Bluetooth and it's pushing a lot of data.
I wondered if it's pushing, like, even if it's pushing binaries to the watch at setup. Because in the instructions, they were very explicit to say, be on the latest iOS. So update your phone to the latest version of iOS so you have the latest version of the watch app and then set it up. Huh. So I think it's actually pushing software to the watch, but I don't know that to be true. But it took that long.
But initially, you like it?
Yeah, so far I think it's cool. It's very comfortable. I like the way it fits. I notoriously have this problem with watches where I'm between notches.
Yeah.
So a watch that has notched holes, this one feels just right. On my Garmin, I always, like, there were two choices, and one was just a little bit too loose and one was just a little bit too tight. And with this watch, it's essential that it be snug so that the heart rate monitor works. So I was worried that it wasn't going to be just right. And I was going to have to switch to, like, the nylon band or something that, you know, you can choose any width. But, no, this fits really nice. I like it. I set up the Unlock My Mac,
which
I just used, and it worked.
Yeah. Did you get an additional band?
I did not.
Okay.
Because I wanted to wait and see the gold. So that was the thing, you know. I held off buying this because I wanted to go see it in a store. Well, then there was a delay, you know, and they weren't in stores and they were nowhere around here and I was going to have to make a trip and I just didn't want to wait. So I was like, I'll just order it. And if I really hate it, then I'll return it.
Right.
So that's why I had kind of waited and I didn't want to buy a second band until I saw the gold and decided, you know, what color I want. But I think I'll probably also get a nylon band. So this is the sport. What is it?
The rubber band, yeah. Basically.
I'll probably get a nylon band too. I think the nylon band's cool. I didn't really want to use it for fitness because it will get wet and sweaty.
Yep.
Whereas this, you can just wipe it off and you're done. Yeah. So my primary use case for this is going to be, other than just a daily, you know, wear your watch, get your text messages, whatever, is I'm going to use it for running. And I'm interested in pairing my chest strap heart rate monitor.
Yeah.
And pairing my Bluetooth headphones to it. So I can run, listen to music, get my heart rate, GPS, all in one.
With no phone.
With no phone. So that's going to be the major test the first time I do that.
You can have, what, one playlist on your watch. Is that right?
I haven't put any music on it yet. I don't know.
I thought we read that the other day. But
okay.
Anyway, we'll talk about it again.
Yeah, so I think tomorrow I'm going to get up. I'm not going to go for a run because it's going to be impossible to run because I want to play with the watch. So I'm going to go for a walk in the morning with my headphones and my heart rate monitor and
see how
it goes. Yeah, get it all, get the kinks worked out, hopefully.
Well, so you can work on your rings, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. Though I don't know exactly, I'll be interested to see how that works, like the standing one, because I work at a standing desk.
You'll do fine.
So I stand all day, but like today, this afternoon when I was wearing it and I was standing, pretty soon it told me to stand because it wants to see essentially a change in altitude. So I'm going to just have to like raise my hand up over my head or something to make the Apple Watch think I'm standing. I don't know. Yeah. Or maybe I can fine tune it so it doesn't have a standing ring. I don't know. I'll have to find out.
Yeah. I look forward to hearing your story.
So far, so good. I like it. I'm definitely pleased with the look of it, which was my initial biggest concern. Buying it sight unseen. But yeah, I'm happy I picked what I picked.
Are you glad you've waited for the Series 2?
Oh, definitely. Like, you know, like we said before, I would never buy it without built-in GPS.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to drag my phone with me on a walk or a jog. So
even a Series 1 watch would not be acceptable to you?
No.
Cool.
Yeah, so now I'm excited to get the AirPods. I'm going to try the AirPods when they come out. I'm a little annoyed that they don't, you know, they haven't announced a date. You can't pre-order them or anything.
My guess is I think the buzz for them has been greater maybe than Apple Forecast.
Yeah.
And so if they're wise, they know that they're going to be a big Christmas seller because $159 or whatever it is that they cost, it's kind of right in that ideal Christmas present.
Right. Kind of like borderline luxury, but...
Yeah. But it's, you know,
affordable, right.
A lot of people would be willing to give that to a spouse or a girlfriend or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And, I think they would be better served by having, excuse me, a larger initial supply.
Yeah.
To try to meet demand initially. So maybe they haven't announced a date because they're holding off trying to stuff their Apple stores with the... with the units.
Okay, so that's part of the reason I'm a little fidgety about it. Like, I don't want it to just show up one day they're available on the website and then bam, they're sold out, because I've read several articles that says, based on surveys of people buying iPhone 7s in stores, you know, essentially something like 80% of the people who have bought an iPhone 7 say they want to buy these headphones. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think that they're probably going to sell out long before Christmas.
Yeah. That's just me being optimistic. It could be that they require iOS 10.1.
Hmm.
And so...
Do you think they'll announce a date in advance, or you think they're just going to show up for sale someday?
It wouldn't surprise me if you get at least a couple of days warning. But we'll see. I am intrigued by them. I'm willing to wait past Christmas, if necessary, to see them
in the wild,
in the wild, and get some real people's perceptions of them. So before I plunk down my filthy lucre, or my hard-earned greenbacks, or whatever the right word is.
So as far as ordering this and getting it delivered, first of all, it said it wouldn't arrive until the end of October. And it's October 18th.
Yep.
So obviously they're ahead of schedule for what they're saying on the website. And second, I had heard that a lot of the Apple Watches or read articles that a lot of them were delayed because they're being shipped.
Yep.
Shipped via sea.
Yeah, boat.
Yeah. This was obviously flown directly because when I got the shipping notice, it left from China.
Yeah.
And then came to Alaska and then made its way to Minnesota. So
I know two people who've ordered iPhone 7s and got them ahead of their expected delivery date, ahead of by like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, clearly Apple chose the under promise over deliver strategy, which is never bad. All right. Let's talk about what we did yesterday, which was go and see Shin Godzilla.
Gojira.
Gojira, yes.
Which now I no longer feel like I'm being offensive saying that, because in the movie...
That's what they say.
The secret project or whatever is codenamed Gojira. Spelled G-O-J-I-R-A, Gojira.
But it was named by the Americans. So, for the people who don't know what this is Japan's newest Godzilla movie, which is in and of itself kind of a reboot of the Godzilla franchise. It has nothing to do with the Hollywood reboot of Godzilla from 2 years ago or whatever. It's a Japanese movie. It's subtitled in English. It was in a very limited release in the United States for approximately a week. I think we saw it right at the tail end of its availability here in the United States. But it's delightful. The special effects are mildly low budget, but in a homage really to Godzilla movies of old. There's no deep questioning or attempt at meaning for why Godzilla comes up out of the sea and starts smashing the Tokyo. No one asks that question. The movie certainly doesn't even attempt to answer it, right? The movie is really about and commentary on how the government reacts to Godzilla and what it does or chooses not to do.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of ways, that's why that movie works. It's a little bit satirical. It's kind of funny in some ways. As a Japanese domestic market movie, I find it has an interesting perspective on the relationship between Japan and the United States, mm-hmm. which they kind of make fun of a little bit. It was a wholly entertaining 2 hours.
Yeah, I guess I don't want to really give away any spoilers, because I would recommend anyone watch that movie if you
absolutely
if you have a sense of humor about, you know, Japanese creature movies.
Yeah.
But I was thoroughly entertained. Yeah, I thought it was really good. It was very funny. The only problem I kind of had, we discussed, so it's in Japanese with English subtitles, and at times there were subtitles and super titles, and it was kind of hard to, like, read the top, read the bottom, see what's going on, read the top, read the bottom, see what's going on. But...
And the super titles, which are usually...
It was like a character name or like the location
or
of what was going on.
You know, whatever the name of the particular committee meeting we were witnessing was. They kept getting longer.
That was the interesting thing, too. I mean, like, most of the movie was spent in, like, government conference rooms, right? With a bunch of people hand-wringing over what to do about this monster that crawled out of the sea, and then hilarity ensues.
That's right. And hilarity ensues. It's really the only way to describe it.
But no, it was very cool. Definitely, it was better. I expected it to be more fun to see, just kind of, you know, as a farce, to kind of mock it. But I actually enjoyed it as a movie, you know, an action movie.
Did people clap after it was done in the theater?
Yeah.
They did. So...
And it was a packed theater on a Monday night.
It was a packed theater on a Monday night. And I think I commented to you while we were in there waiting for it to fill up that it was, I don't know if it was reassuring, but it was a theater full of people that made me feel like I was the normal one. Right? Which is saying something.
It was an interesting crowd.
Yeah. So it was good. If you haven't seen it, go see it. Hopefully it comes to Netflix. It's worth your time.
I don't know if it'll show up in America, you know? I mean, I guess it'll be on the torrents for sure, but I don't know if it'll... Do you think it'll be on Netflix or Hulu or somewhere?
I would assume that its reception... Like, we enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in our theater enjoyed it. I don't think, you know, the random 200 people that saw it in uptown Minneapolis on a random Monday night were an anomaly. I would assume people enjoyed it all over the United States. So there's money to be made,
yeah,
right, by having it available in one form or another.
Hmm.
And I assume that whoever the distributor is in Japan will figure out how to make that happen. So,
cool.
Since we're talking about movies, maybe we should talk about this blog post that is actually a couple years old, but I came to it by way of a Netflix short, like an animated, you know, 4-minute Netflix thing that Netflix actually put on YouTube, which is a strange confluence of events. But it's about the Back to the Future trilogy. The supposition that the whole trilogy is one big chiasmus. I think that's how you say that word, right?
Were you familiar with this word? Had you heard this before you came across this piece? No. I've never heard this before.
Yeah. But it's it makes sense about what it is, right? It's a writing structure where ideas are listed in one order and then repeated in the opposite order to form the complete idea. And the example given in the in this blog post is the Hickory Dickory Dock nursery rhyme, right? Ran up the clock, Clark stuck one, mouse ran down, Hickory Dickory Dock, right? So there's a kind of a, you know, a structure, right? And so this person has taken the time to go through all three of the movies and list them in order, right? They all have letters. They're all slightly indented from one another, but it starts at A, you know, and then B and C, right? And he goes all the way up to EE, which happens in the middle of Back to the Future Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then it, everything unwinds. And they all have kind of a neat symmetry. I mean, this blog post is, you know, 10 billion words, right? Because it, in addition to the highlights of what every one of these is, there's like a 3-paragraph explanation along with pictures for every letter and its matching part together. So it's compelling, right, that this could potentially be the case. I don't know. What did you think?
I think it's interesting. You know, I look, this guy has done this with other storyline, you know, other stories, other movies. Seems like it's reaching a little bit to me.
Of course it is.
But it works.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure it wasn't intentional. You think it was intentional?
Well, certainly there's a lot of attention to detail in the first Back to the Future. That's part of what makes it so interesting, right? Like the, you know, I can remember even when I saw this movie in the theater, right? The name of the shopping mall where he first meets a DeLorean is the Twin Pines Mall. And then when he goes back in time, he runs over a pine.
Hmm.
And then when he comes back at the end of the movie, it's the Lone Pines Mall.
Mm-hmm. Right?
'Cause there's only, you know, 'cause Marty ran over a pine. And, you know, there's lots of little details like that stuck all over that movie. And in a lot of ways around subsequent movies too, right? The, you know, in episode 3, there's the ravine, you know, it changes from the Clara ravine or whatever it was called, right? Because the teacher fell into it and they save her at the beginning of the movie into the Clint Eastwood ravine because the you know, that's the name that Marty takes when he goes back in time, and he theoretically goes off the end in the train, right? So there's lots of little details like that throughout the movies. And I don't know. I mean, in a lot of ways, the movies are always the same. This is the same movie told three times. So,
so I have to make a confession. I haven't watched these movies in like 15 years.
Really?
And so the key takeaway from reading this was I need to watch these movies immediately.
I have them on disc, sitting on my shelf.
You know, it's just one of those things that you can't rewatch everything constantly, and it's been far too long since I've watched these. So
that
I would
like
to watch the trilogy and then go through this article again when it's all fresh in my head again.
It sounds like maybe that's a bottle of scotch and a three movies on a Saturday afternoon sort of activity.
We could make that happen. So I did look up, I'm not a phonetic expert, but I think it's chiasmus. Chiasmus.
Is that what I said? Or did I say
I don't remember what you said.
Okay. Chiasmus.
It starts with a K in the phonetic pronunciation.
Yeah.
So.
But Back to the Future is one of those movies that just kind of refuses to die, and that's part of why I love it.
I really hope they don't try and remake it or make a fourth movie.
I
can't believe they haven't tried to. I mean, they started making more Indiana Jones movies.
Yeah. But in some ways, they maybe learned their lesson.
Maybe.
So.
But yeah, this conceptually is really cool. This guy who did this obviously is a film lover and has a lot of time on his hands. So
there was that documentary recently about the Back to the Future people, right?
Uh-huh.
Did you see this?
It's on my radar. Like, I'm aware of it, but yeah. I haven't watched it. I think it's on Netflix.
It is. That's where I watched it.
Okay. I should watch that too.
You know, the original Back to the Future, the actor cast in it originally was different. They even started filming. Right? They were several...
You mean it wasn't Michael J. Fox?
No.
Who was it?
I forget the gentleman's name, right? But they, after watching some of the dailies, are like, this is just really not our guy, right? And so they went back and they got Michael J. Fox and they filmed it over again.
Huh.
Right? So, you know, part of what makes that movie work is the almost, I don't know, earnestness, I guess, of Michael J. Fox's character, right? Certainly has the right chemistry of people. But all right, so maybe we should move on from there, since we're talking about Hollywood. This little article I found on The All about Julia Child. It's like this little mini history of Julia Child. Did you read this?
Yeah. So first I would comment on this concept. So what this article is called, Julia Child Facts. And it's essentially like her life told through like bullet points.
Yeah.
You know, just like tidbits. And this is actually a really cool way to, you know, get a historical skeleton of somebody. Like, to me, this is much preferable than reading her Wikipedia page.
Right.
You know, there was something about this that I took more out of this, because it's like the most important points of her life. You know, it's just like single sentences, you know, like it starts off when she was born. You
right.
know? And
it's a... Yeah, so a lot of people know a lot of the story of Julia Child, and in a lot of ways, it's not all that, you know, a lot of the story of Julia Child is told in the Julia movie. I don't know if you ever watched that.
Yeah, for which the Julia part is great, and the Julie part is kind of annoying.
Fair.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't that be a better movie if you just cut out the Julia Child's part and just made that its own little... 45-minute movie?
Certainly what is interesting is Julia Child's life story is compelling because it's unorthodox. So, you know, she went to college,
And things happen very late in her life, which I actually found that to be very encouraging. Being someone who's in my mid-30s without necessarily a lot of direction. I mean, she didn't start her career as a chef until, what did they say, like 37, 38?
I think she was 37 when she enrolled in chef school.
Chef school, exactly.
Yeah, and Le Cordon Bleu in 1949. She was 37.
So a lot of the stuff in here, yeah, she just kind of marched to the beat of her own drummer.
But, I mean, she was literally too tall. In World War II, she was too tall to enlist in the Army or Navy Corps for women. What a bizarre requirement.
Yeah. What did it say? She was 6'1"?
6'2",
I think.
6'2"? Right. But, you know, it's a war, and we really want everybody to help, and we're happy that you want to help, but you know, you're just too tall.
I'm sure it's just they had like regulations for like uniforms and stuff, and they just didn't have equipment for her. It's like, we're not going to manufacture a special uniform for someone. We just accept the people who fall within the demographics such that
it's so absurd.
Yeah,
right. But so she ended up joining the Office of Strategic Services, which apparently had wider latitude of what uniforms people could wear. And then she was a typist and then a researcher for the Secret Intelligence Division. Like, that seems really interesting to me. Like, yeah. I would like 4 or 5 more paragraphs about that, but nope.
So
we get from there is, you know, she was a spy in World War II, and one of her projects involved cooking. I mean, she helped develop a repellent for sharks. And it's still in use today.
Yeah.
How bizarre is that? I don't know. It's a fascinating story. So we'll drop this in the links. People can read it and spend 5 minutes of your life and be fascinated.
Yeah, I will honestly say, not just from reading this, but also from seeing the movie, from what I've read before about Julia Child, it's probably someone I would enjoy a biography about. I'm sure there's a good biography that has been written about her.
You'd hope so, anyway. Yeah.
Very interesting life, indeed.
There was, I believe a few years ago, there was a traveling exhibition of her kitchen traveling around. Hmm. And my girlfriend and I went to go see it. I remember because it was, you know, she was so tall, and in the kitchen they lived in after they came back to the United States. Her husband, Paul, built the kitchen, and the cabinets were taller for her. And there were like pegboards everywhere that had the outlines of all the utensils that went on them, right? It was not the type of kitchen that you would see in a Better Homes and Gardens magazine, you know, or a Country Living magazine.
But it was probably incredibly functional.
It was the type of kitchen, though, where you looked at it and you're like, I bet you some really sweet food came right out of here, right? Like, I bet you sitting down at the table in there and having lunch was awesome. So, yeah.
I didn't explore this site, so does this site do this? Is this something they do? Like, pick a...
I don't know.
Pick an individual and just give me the facts?
Yeah, I haven't looked either. Around. I haven't looked either. So, all right, what should we talk about next? You want to talk about the Nerd Writer Explorers Bob Dylan All Along the Watchtower?
Yeah, that's very... So it's interesting. You know, we first looked at this a while back. It was in the... It's been in our To Talk About list for a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's even more relevant now that Bob Dylan is winning the Nobel... And Prize for Literature.
They haven't contacted him.
That's hilarious.
Only right. Adding to his legend.
I read that today. He has yet to... So what is it? 3-4 days now?
I thought it's been like a week.
Last week? Yeah. He has yet to acknowledge publicly that he has been awarded
but
the
he's
Nobel
given
Prize.
A concert since then.
That's what I mean. Yeah. So he's been in public.
In fact, I think the Rolling Stones came on stage after he did... And Mick Jagger commented about, we've never shared a stage before with a Nobel winner, right? And
but he has yet to acknowledge that he actually has received it. You know, I think it's very interesting. I think not to preempt the video here, but I think he's obviously well deserving of it. I'm sure he is one of those people that his name has probably been on the list for a number of years. You know, maybe for, I'm sure they maintain kind of this list of people over time, people who are still producing work. And I wouldn't doubt that he's been on the list for, you know, 15 years or something. And it's interesting why this year is the year they pick. I don't know if it has something to do, you know, I don't know that he's really produced anything that was that compelling as of late. It's more of his entire life's body of work that the award is for. But why did they pick him this year? You know, does that have something to do with the state of the world, with the state of the, you know, United States?
I don't know.
Like, it's, that's the part that's so interesting to me is, like, why now? It's kind of like when they gave Obama the Nobel Peace Prize just, like, for not being George W. Bush. You know, it's something that maybe as an individual he would be worthy of someday, but it's like, why that, at that moment in time, that seemed like a bad choice. At that moment in time,
yeah,
you know, this, I don't know. I don't know that this is a bad choice, but it's interesting.
It is.
2016 is the year that Bob Dylan, you know, is recognized for his poetic genius with a Nobel Prize, right?
So the, speaking of President Obama getting the Nobel Peace Prize, there, I watched a clip of him today on Colbert. And, you know, it was some funny clip where Colbert was trying to help Obama sharpen his skills because he's soon going to be unemployed and, you know, he's going to need to find a job in a competitive market. And, you know, they get to the part where he's getting this, you know, like interview counseling. You know, and they're like, well, have you won any awards? You know? And, of course, the Nobel Peace Prize comes up. I'm like, oh, what'd you win that for? He's like, I don't know. So it's funny to me that he can at least make fun of it, right? So, I don't know. It's an interesting job being the President of the United States. Not a job I think I'd want.
Mm. So this particular video that we had looked at was somebody explaining the meaning in the song All Along the Watchtower.
Right.
Or not really explaining, more just kind of like raising a bunch of questions about what it means. Because there is no real explaining the song.
No, the thing that was most important about it to me is that the first half of the song, you know, the Joker and the thief, right? And then the second half of the song, you know, two riders approaching, the idea that you could, that the song could then like loop around to its quote unquote beginning again, and maybe those two riders are the Joker and the thief, right? And that the, that maybe you've entered into this circular narrative
right
in the middle and it's kind of being told to you backwards from its tradition.
You kind of jumped into the middle of it.
Yeah.
And then it wraps around. I did really like that idea.
That was my most favorite idea of the whole thing. And, but the, it, you know, the basic question, like it, it's such a short piece of fiction in this song, but it, it's really compelling. Like it makes you want to know, who are the writers and where are they going and what about this princess, right? And the castle and I mean, there's just, you know, what is the backstory of the Joker and the thief? I mean, the it's such a short thing, but it's such a compelling
thing. I think the first time this song was really on my radar was when it came up in Battlestar, you know. Remember, this is a song that when the final five are waking up, it starts, you know, droning in their heads. And I remember at the time, I think when we were watching Battlestar, then we started watching all the covers. Like everyone has covered this song essentially. And it's one of those songs that's very interesting.
I wonder if Prince has a cover of this song.
A previous episode could be merged. This is one of the most highly covered songs, and it's really interesting to see everybody's take on it. And the thing is, I mean, Bob Dylan, like, I like the Jimi Hendrix version. I don't think any of the Bob Dylan performances of it are my favorite. And our friend Paul, who's a big Dylan fan,
disagrees.
Thought he was going to slap me when I said that to him once. So I guess maybe that's blasphemy. But I mean, it's an amazing song. I prefer the Jimi Hendrix version of it. It's more rockin'.
Yeah, I think I prefer the Jimi Hendrix version as well. It's certainly the most popular. I will say I do have a growing appreciation
for the Dylan version.
For the Bob Dylan version.
Yeah.
So it's not that I don't like it. Mm-hmm. I maybe just don't like it quite as well as the one that I effectively grew up on.
Maybe that's it. You know, that's the one that I knew first and best. But
yeah, even before I was even conscious of what it was trying to tell me. So
in the video, you know, he explored some interesting theories of who the Joker is and who the thief is, you know, whether it was potentially religious overtones or whether it was, topical at the time the song came out. You know, he made some reference to perhaps the thief is Elvis or, like, you know, stealing music.
Maybe.
Like, it was kind of interesting. I don't know if... I mean, Dylan is one of those people who notoriously doesn't ever say what something means, right?
No, because it ruins the mystery of a song, right? The greatest works of music, at least of popular music, the music that has the longest legs, are the ones for which the lyrics are just vague enough, just interesting enough that the listener,
literal meaning is not known.
The listener fills in what it means. Like, what does it mean to you?
Right.
Right. How does it mean something to you now? And everybody's familiar with this, right? If you have some, you know, large emotional moment in your life, right? Whenever you broke up with your high school sweetheart, for instance, right? Every song on the radio was some horrible love song that made you wanted to kill yourself, right? But you'd heard those songs probably 1,000 times before, and then suddenly they now have meaning because something that's going on in your life. And sometimes that's just stuff that's in the moment, but there's some music like this song, for instance, that seems to transcend, you know, generations even, right? Because it still has meaning to people 10 years later and 20 years later, and what it means to people changes a little bit, I think. You know, some music has longevity and others doesn't. This one does. Autoplay.
Damn you, autoplay. So, you know, the interesting thing about this, and I actually don't like this, but you remember when we first looked at this, or when you first looked at this link like a month ago, the title on YouTube was something like The Meaning Behind All Along the Watchtower, something like that. Did you see what it is today?
No.
It's Why Bob Dylan Won the Nobel Prize. Ugh. So he's trying to cash in.
Hooray for SEO, baby.
Yeah, he's trying, this dude, like, fine, he's trying to make a living on the internet, go you. But he changed the title of the video to try and cash in on the topical Google search.
It's smart, I guess.
It's kind of skeevy.
Yeah. So, okay. Let's talk about this Swedish thing. Did you read this?
I did, and I feel like you put this in here to intentionally, like, kind of like poke at me.
You realize I put this link in here long before
sure.
you started buying disposable clothes.
So anyway, it's called Sweden Wants You to Fight Our Disposable Culture with Tax Breaks for Repairing Old Stuff. Which was super funny when I looked at it today.
Yeah.
Because we were just talking last night about how I was wearing a sweatshirt I bought at Costco and jeans I bought at Old Navy. And I was talking about my disposable clothing.
Which is typical American clothing.
Indeed.
It's not like you're doing something especially egregious, right? You're doing what almost everybody does, right? You know, one of the things that if you get past the politics of climate change and you look at, you know, what does it really mean to, you know, be a thoughtful conservationist? And, you know, if you leave all of that tree hugger crap on the side and you say, what does it really mean to be wise with money? One of the things you'll come to is, you know, consumerism and our disposable culture are bad on lots of levels, right? They
can wasteful seem, in lots of different ways.
Right. They can seem, you know, inexpensive in the short term, but, you know, the long-term costs are dramatic. And the environmental costs can seem inconsequential, but as it turns out, they add up over the long haul, right? And so I found it interesting that, you know, Sweden, which has a relatively high tax burden anyway, right, for their socialist country, chose to use the tax code to try to coerce people into doing the right thing. Now, you don't have to know me very long or put very many drinks in me to get me talking about how much I really dislike when our Congress
tries to control behavior.
Tries to, you know, induce behavior via with the tax taxes, code. Yeah. Simply because there's a ton of side effects.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Unintended consequences. And undoubtedly there will be some for this. But
so we didn't really say the gist of the article here is they're trying to pass legislation so you have to pay no tax on getting things repaired. And there's going to be excess tax on things that are unrepairable or disposable.
I thought it was like the tax was going to be cut in half. Like normally the tax is like 25%. It was going to be like 12% or something like that. Right. But they were giving you a strong tax incentive to repair something.
And then a negative incentive to buy unrepairable things.
Right. And that's a powerful thing, right? Because the, you know, if you're 15-year-old washing machine breaks, it can be very tempting to say, oh, you know, why would I spend $400 to repair it for, you know, maybe $800? I could just buy a new one and then it's new. Well, except that now you've thrown out the old one. Part of it too, hopefully Sweden isn't big enough to really move world markets, but if ideas like this catch on, products could go back to being slightly more repairable. Undoubtedly, you know, Apple built that, you know, robot to take apart iPhones, you know, that they talked about 8 months ago or whatever. Undoubtedly, the process of going through that and trying to figure out how to take apart the, you know, that which they have created, undoubtedly informs them on what it means to build the next one, because you have in your brain how hard is it going to be for the next robot to take this one apart,
right? In a way, Apple had to do that because they were one of the biggest offenders in technology of making stuff unrepairable.
Yeah,
right. And I mean, can't replace the battery, can't crack it open. I mean, they're always the biggest. They're always the worst as far as like iFixit's complaints about, you know, technology products that can't be fixed. Computers too. I mean, my first MacBook Pro, you know, had a replaceable battery and you could take out everything. You know, the bottom came off and, well, this one, you can't do anything. So anyway, I think Apple got to this point where they were a major offender in the repairability of things. And then their answer to that is the recyclability.
Right. In Apple's case, they would argue it's not something that you can repair, and it's not something that the folks from iFixit can repair, but it's something that we, Apple, can repair. Right.
So as long as we're willing to take it back and be responsible for that, then...
And traditionally they have been. Mm-hmm. That's probably the exception to the rule. I don't know. I'm having a hard time sticking to my principles of using, you know, tax incentives to induce mm-hmm. behavior being a bad thing. In this case, maybe it's a good thing. It certainly sends a signal to the market. You hope that it's interpreted the right way, right? Like you hope that somebody doesn't figure out some sort of, you know, way to make consumerism go even faster and take advantage of a tax break when doing it. Like you hope that it really allows for, you know, people to choose to get stuff repaired, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look around, it can be done. It's sometimes strangely not as efficient as you might think, right? Like I have a little trickle charger, you know, a Deltran battery tender that I keep on a car battery, right, in a car to keep the battery charged. And last week, it just stopped working, right? I unplugged it to use the car. I went to plug it back in, and the charger had lost its mind. I contacted the company. They happened to be in Florida, so we were delayed by a hurricane. But I'd taken a video, you know, uploaded it to Vimeo. Hey, this is what my thing is doing. It's not right. And they, you know, they asked a couple of questions, you know, because that thing comes with like a 5-year warranty. So they asked for the date code that was printed on the thing. And they said, oh, yeah, I, you know, send it back and we'll look at it. You know, assuming it's not been abused, we should be able to replace this under warranty. So, you know, buying a new one of these things is like $40. And I spent just under $13 today.
To send it to them.
To, you know.
Not to mention finding a box, packaging it, getting the address on it.
Yeah. I spent $13
and probably, an hour of your time.
Yeah, probably about the time I drove to the post office and stuff and used that infuriating automated postal machine. I hate that thing. you know, it was an hour of my time, right? And so you could say, well, is that an efficient use of your time and money? And strictly speaking, from a traditional economic standpoint, the answer is no, right? Most efficient thing for me to do would have been to spend 4 minutes and order a new one on Amazon and have it delivered to me in a couple of days and plug it in and go, right? But the idea that they might be able to take this thing apart and figure out whatever 89-cent thing is wrong with it and fix it and return it to me, or refurbish it and send me a different refurbished one, which then means this thing doesn't end up in a landfill. That to me was kind of like the important part of it, right? That's the part where it's hard to calculate that in the spreadsheet of what's the valuable and right thing to do. And I don't know. I mean, this thing, you know, you could say, well, it weighs, you know, its shipping weight, including the box and everything, was 2 pounds, 2 ounces, right? So this thing maybe weighs 1.5 pounds. I mean, it's not very big, right? So the volume you'd put into a landfill is low. There's probably not a lot of things that are particularly toxic in it. I mean, it's effectively a power supply and voltage regulator with a tiny little printed circuit board, you know, with a microchip monitoring some algorithms, right? So, you know, it's in terms of economic or environmental impact compared to like a mobile phone, it's probably way less than that, right? So, you know.
I mean, in this particular case, too, you actually are saving money. I mean, you'll ultimately save 20-some dollars, right? I'd bend over and pick up $20, depending on how much you...
How much is an hour of your time worth, right?
You know, I mean, essentially the pleasure you're getting from this act of repairing something is worth something too.
I don't even know if they repair it.
You know,
I mean, these people could just toss it in the dumpster and.
But still, you've done all you can do, right?
It's true. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know what the right answer here is, right? I guess my own personal makeup makes me lean a little bit more towards doing this sort of thing, right? Because mm-hmm. it's not like I'm foregoing, you know, an additional hour of, you know, consulting for $500 an hour, right, in order to do this. What it really means is that I...
Depends on how busy you are. I mean, how right. much you can...
But, you know, like a normal person... time. What it really means is that I've foregone an extra hour of...
Netflix
or reading the book that I'm currently reading or something yeah. like that, right? Like I've foregone, yeah. you know, some sort of pleasure activity, right?
And you obviously wanted to do this and took pleasure out of doing it, so yeah. what the heck?
Of course, now, you know, the battery... The car... And this battery, the car through its own natural state, there is nothing wrong with the car or the electrical system in it, but it will drain a full, completely charged battery to so dead the lights won't even turn on in 6 weeks. Hmm. Like, that's why this car has to be on a car charger, right? Because if it sits for very long, it'll just drain the battery.
So, I mean, can you just leave the battery unhooked?
You could.
Until you drive it again? And...
But it's, you know, now I have to think about that. Right? Yeah. I mean, I drove the car today. I'm going to drive it next week because it's going to go for service and stuff like that. So it probably won't end up being a big deal. But, you know, like I'm on a timer now right. to not have a dead battery again.
Right? Yeah.
For years, I've not had dead
battery. Right, because the sole purpose of that device is so you don't have to worry about right. it. And so now that device is...
So now we can discuss, you know, well, how environmentally sound is that? You idiot. You've yeah. got a
constant
second...
energy. Oh, right. man, we just had a conversation about this a couple weeks ago. Burn.
That's right.
What are you doing wasting all that electricity?
Yeah, I have a second car. Right? Oh. Purely for pleasurable purposes.
You hypocrite.
right? yeah, I don't know how to reconcile all those things, right? But there's, I guess the simplest way to look at it is there are places for which you can expend a little effort and not be such a dick to the environment while still, you know, accommodating the things that are ultimately detrimental to the environment, but give you some sort of meaningful indulgence in your life, right? Some sort of meaningful thing in your life,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you know, getting on an airplane is bad for the environment, right? Puts out a lot of pollution high up in the atmosphere, right? But if it takes you to... you know, see the Great Barrier Reef, or it takes you to visit your, you know, your relatives in the old country, or it takes you to, you know, the Louvre, right? That's maybe worth it, right? Because you're going to gain some cultural insight, or, you know, see some natural beauty somewhere else in the world, right? So. Mm-hmm. Humanity is, in a lot of ways, a contradiction.
Yeah. So I do have to say, since I started off by confessing about my disposable clothes habit, in other areas of my life, I'm pretty good about buying quality products mm-hmm. and getting them repaired. It just happens to be on clothes.
You still haven't watched that Patagonia video.
I haven't. It's just, I feel like there's a lot of inefficiency involved. I guess I have two main reasons. I feel like there's a lot of inefficiency involved in getting clothes repaired. Like, you know, I have a hole in my jeans. I have to take them to someone, you know, I can't fix clothes myself. I have to take it to a seamstress or a tailor and drop it off and then go back and pick it up. And I just, you know, I don't know. It ends up being a lot of time to have mm-hmm. clothes repaired. I have had, you know, I've had a coat repaired before. I've had shoes resold, whatever it is,
yeah.
Done before. But just in general, I don't like to buy expensive clothes, and I don't like to have clothes repaired. And my second reason for that is my size changes a lot. I mean, if I look at how many times my size has changed in the last 15 years, just my jean size, up and down and up and down and up and down. You know, you buy a nice pair of jeans at one size and you lose 20 pounds and...
They don't fit so well anymore.
So I like to buy jeans at Old Navy. The ones I was wearing last night were $15.
Yep.
And wear them for 3 months and then buy new ones. And cheap clothes only last about that long. Like, it doesn't take long before the belt loops are ripping off, and then eventually the crotch will rip.
Yep.
And then they're done. So I don't know. You know, I should explore. I know that there are ways to do to recycle fabric. Like, people will accept ripped denim, and it gets recycled into dog toys, and I don't know. There are all kinds of things they do with recycled fabric. Is that a compromise solution for wearing disposable clothes?
Well, it's probably better than putting in a landfill. growing cotton as cheaply as possible is generally pretty bad for the environment. So,
because fertilizer
and pesticides,
water and pesticides
and water. Yeah. So, you know, if you're going to use something and then just throw it away, if you can figure out how to recycle that into some other useful product that will, you know, diminish demand for some other natural resource, right? That is in and of itself not a terrible thing. But the overall life cycle of buying a pair of jeans and wearing them for 3 months, then getting a different one, but the total number of jeans you would potentially buy over a lifetime compared to me, who typically buys one pair of jeans a year, and then, you know, initially they're my super nice pair of jeans, and then they're just an everyday pair of jeans, and then, you know, they're jeans that I wear mowing the yard or washing the car or, you know, doing some sort of backyard construction project, right? You know, that process for me to completely go through a pair of jeans probably takes on the order of 3 or 4 years, maybe more, maybe less, it depends. I have to get them repaired typically 2 or 3 times over the lifetime, right? Because, you know, some part will wear thin and I'll have to get it, you know, it'll start to rip and I'll have to get it sewn. And
let me guess, it's the belt loops and the crotch.
The jeans that I had for the 3 years that I had an iPhone 5, there is an outline in my pocket, the exact size and shape of an iPhone 5.
Oh, okay.
Right. And other jeans have, where my keys tend to ride in the pocket. Like, I just literally just wore through the fabric there, just because the fabric is always, you sit down with your keys in your pocket and they just kind of rub over it. And, but yeah, typically belt loops in the crotch, right? But that stuff can be repaired.
Yeah. So I looked in, Goodwill does accept torn and unwearable clothing to recycle in other ways.
There you go.
So I could at least do that.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a hybrid approach that could work out better for you. There are some, the upside is you're a man, which means classic styles change very slowly. So, the editors at GQ might have a hard time with this, but if you buy a pair of Levi's 501 jeans, there is almost no situation in which jeans are appropriate that you can't wear 501s.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And your size may change. And I understand that. So over the course of, 2 years, you might have to buy 4 pairs to accommodate your accordion sizes. Mm-hmm. But once you have, the size 38s or the size 42s.
No, because once you go down a size, you never keep the size bigger because you're never going back there.
But you could keep the Levi's.
Okay.
Right? Because they're Ultimately, they might end up, you know, being interesting from a vintage standpoint, right? But the, you know, you would have those things, and then they could last you for years, and then you could fill in the others with your more disposable $15 jeans from Old Navy. I'm just saying.
I'll think about it.
I encourage you, you know, I'm not trying to be critical of how you choose to buy and use clothes, but if you spend any time at all trying to understand, you know, the supply chains that go into the things that you make, you'll quickly come to understand how, you know, it's impractical and quite frankly not that interesting to, you know, have some notion of living like a monk, right? Like, mm-hmm. I really like my computers and my cars and my iPhones, right? But the best and easiest thing that you can do is just have less of them.
Right.
Right. This is why I think I've discussed in the past why I generally only buy an iPhone once every 3 years, right? It's tempting to get one every 2 years and just paying the Apple the monthly rent to get a new iPhone every year would be a wonderful indulgence, right? Mm-hmm. But the environmental costs of that are a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, as I typically tell people, when the new iPhone comes out, you've generally got the best phone on planet Earth. And a year later, when the next new iPhone comes out, you've got the second best or maybe the third best phone on planet Earth if there's some new awesome flagship Android phone, right? Mm-hmm. So for the first 2 years, you've effectively got one of the best phones on the planet, right? And in the third year, you're just a...
Get over it.
You're just a chum with an old phone, but this is your... This is what you're doing for Mother Earth, right?
Yeah. I have a feeling this would be a pretty... Back to the tax aspect of it. It would be a pretty regressive tax because lower quality goods are going to be taxed more, right?
Well...
like in our concept of Old Navy jeans, right? The tax would be higher on the Old Navy jeans than it would be on...
Well, so if you buy one $15 pair of Old Navy jeans every 3 months, you'll have purchased four pairs of jeans for $60 over the course of a year, and you'll have paid, you know, whatever the tax is on that. We happen to live in the state of Minnesota, so there's no tax on clothes. This is a bad example, right? But, you know, I just bought a new pair of Levi's 501s. It's the only pair I've bought in 2016. I think the last ones I bought were in the summer of 2015. Oh, I could probably look on Amazon and find out, right? But it's been quite a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they were, I don't know, $45 or something like that, right?
Okay.
So, you know, and I have, you know, I have a belief that they'll last me for several years, right? So the, you know, the cost per wear of my jeans will go down dramatically, right? Over the many years that I'll own them. But
okay,
so that's, I mean, that's a strict case for, you know, does the spreadsheet math make sense, right? But then there's all the intangibles, which is easy not to be aware of if you don't want to be. But with a little bit of work, you can understand what's really going on, right? Or at least have a better sense of what goes on. So, yeah, in any case, despite my better judgment, I think potentially this tax incentive to repair broken stuff is maybe a good thing.
And then the funniest part was at the end of the article, it talks about IKEA.
Yeah.
You know, how, you know, IKEA is Swedish, and in the mid-90s, they had a ad campaign that essentially said, get rid of everything in your house, throw it away, and come to IKEA and get all new stuff.
Which makes strict sense if you're a marketer for IKEA, right?
Yep.
Come buy our fancy stuff. So, All right. How are we doing on time?
Yeah, we could probably wrap it up.
All right. Well, let's end on something fun. McMansion Hell. Have you perused this?
I did go through it. Man, there's some ugly houses.
Yes.
So tell me, what's this article?
Well, this is somebody's blog, right? Somebody's got a I don't know if it's a WordPress site or whatever, right? Where I think they're either an architecture student or a young architect. And they just find houses that are for sale, right? They're just using, you know, pictures on the internet of houses that are for sale. And they're just ripping apart, this is a McMansion, and it's terrible. Let me tell you why. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of funny.
So then where you had me start, where I started reading this was, she, I think it's a she.
Is it a
gal? Yeah. She has this scale of like 1 to 10 of how terrible it is. And yeah. Then she goes through and gives examples at each level of the scale and, you know, what makes McMansion, which was really interesting.
Yeah. I've received 100 emails regarding the McMansion scale from last Thursday.
And one of her biggest complaints, and actually this is a complaint I have when you see, you know, these very large suburban houses, is when it's what I think she says is more roof than house. You know, it has just the huge peaked roofs, you know, and it's always kind of broken up in all these different sections. And
yep.
What is she? She had another term. I think she called it roof soup or something. You know, when you have like literally a dozen different angles and layers to the roof of a house.
Right. I don't live in a house that's big enough to be considered a McMansion. I think I estimated my house was a 3 or a 4. I'd have to go back and look again, but you know, I've just got a ranch.
Right? Yep. Same here. I guessed that my house would be a 3.
Yeah.
I am in general anti big house, because I don't like having a bunch of space to take care of and clean. And the more house you have, the more stuff you have. Like, I'm always in this mood to downsize. So the idea of filling, you know, a massive 5,000 square foot house is...
Well, you don't have to fill it. Step one. I do occasionally fantasize about just burning my house down and driving away.
Starting over.
But some people are obsessed with, you know, square footage and number of bathrooms and all that other stuff, right? I've probably mentioned before, when I eventually chose to buy a house, you know, being the idiot I am, I read several books on the subject before I plunged in with both feet. And what I eventually came to determine was the way to think about a house was how you think about software design, right? Like, what are the things that you want your house to do, right? Because in a lot of ways, your house is effectively a machine. It's a machine for you to live. So how do you live? What do you want to do when you live, right? And once you start thinking about the things that are important to you and how you want to live, then you can start to define how the house should be...
To make that happen.
You know, designed and laid out. Mm-hmm. And the things it should have and the things it doesn't need in order to make that, you know, be the case, right? So once I was able to think about it that way, I was able to find a house that was effectively the smallest size available that fits all of my needs, or at least what I perceived my needs to be mm-hmm. at the time I bought the house. Which is great because, you know, I've been in many houses that are much bigger than mine that don't necessarily accommodate any additional needs, you know, don't accommodate any additional actions that my house does not accommodate.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, you know, you can have a party with, you know, 10 or 12 people in my house pretty comfortably, but in a bigger house, you can maybe have a party with 25 people more comfortably. It rarely do I go through times in my life where I have 25 people I actually want at my house.
At the same time, yeah. Yeah,
so, so I'm probably okay there.
If you're to that point, you don't need a bigger house, you need less friends.
Yeah, well, you know, there is a certain irony of being kind of introverted as I am and having a podcast, but...
She's very anti-turret, which she should be. Like, all these crazy houses that have these random turrets.
Yeah. They're just architectural flourishes for no purpose.
Right. It's just like, oh, that would look cool.
One of the books I read that was very helpful for me when I was looking for a house was a woman who was an architect, and she'd written this book. And her basic argument was, if you're going to go build a 5,000 or a 6,000 square foot house... Don't go find an architect, and some of the money that you would spend buying this gigantic house, you're going to spend on an architect, and they're going to design for you a 3,000 or 4,000 foot house that's going it's to be efficient. Infinitely better,
yes,
than the 6,000 foot monstrosity you think you want to buy.
Yep.
And that advice is probably true. If nothing else, because an architect will understand the client and build a machine to suit the client's needs. For better or worse, right? That's what's going to happen. So. All right, what else you got? Anything?
No, I'm going to keep an eye on McMansion Hell.
It's something that I find, I check on it a couple times a week, and there's always something kind of funny to read there. Which is a refreshing change from politics.
Yeah. And we're going to stop right there.
Until next time.
All right. See you, man.